Hello and welcome to South Asia Chat, a podcast series brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. My name is Saiduddin Faridi. I'm a research analyst here, and I will be your host for today's episode on the ongoing farmers' protest in India. Last month, farmer groups launched the Delhi Chalo March to demand a legally backed minimum support price for their produce. The government and farm leaders have gone through several rounds of discussions and negotiations on these demands, but there have been no breakthroughs. The farmers rejected the government's offer of a 5-year contract for guaranteed prices for 5 crops and are seeking a guaranteed minimum price for 23 crops. During the protests, we saw how for several weeks protesters in trucks and tractors were blocked from entering New Delhi by heavy security deployments within and outside the city, which included the use of tear gas, internet shutdowns, and the blocking of roads leading to Delhi. Thousands of farmers have now made their way to the capital on trains and buses to continue the protest. To discuss this critical issue, we have with us today Mr. Harish Damodaran. Mr. Damodaran is the National Rural Affairs and Agriculture Editor for the Indian Express. Mr. Damodaran, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Saeed. Thank you for having me here.
I would like to begin the conversation today by looking at what are the demands of the farmers who are protesting, and if there is a linkage between the demands being made today and the demands made previously during the farmers' protests that took place in 2020 and 2021.
First of all, people say that these are only from Punjab, these farmers are only from Punjab and Haryana. Let's be clear that all agrarian movements, are always local movements, So if you take, for example, some of the most successful ones, you had the Kheda and Bardoli movement of Sardar Patel. That was again, localized to Gujarat, largely central and south Gujarat, right? And the people were mostly patidars at that time. Right, and it was after Kheda and Bardoli that patidars entered the freedom struggle movement, the national struggle movement in a very big way. So I think that is something which we need to first understand. So when people say that it's only farmers of Punjab and Haryana, So it's not this thing, but as I said, this is the case with all farm movements. Because farmers are a very obviously, they're spread across the country, and they are rarely unionized. Okay, so the Punjab and Haryana farmers are the ones who are probably the most unionized, most organized. Okay, and we know that even your labor movements, etc., it comes largely from the organized labor. Okay. So I think this is one thing which we need to take into account. Now, coming to what you said about 2021, these farmers have some kind of a sixth sense. You can call it a sixth sense. They felt that this whole idea of ending the monopoly of APMCs, giving more play to the private trade, to the private purchasers. They saw it as some kind of a, government wanting to, retreat, and basically they saw this as leading to, ultimately you can call it the BSNLization of the APMCs, So they felt that basically government wants to, by opening up the farm trade to the private corporates. Basically government wants to relinquish its role and government is going to stop procurement, MSP procurement, etc. Okay, so that was what led to the moment there. Okay, and those farmers were pretty successful, right? You know that the Modi government had to repeal the 3 farm laws. Okay, so now what we are having now in one way is actually a continuation. Yes, the actors again are more or less the same. Okay, maybe we don't have many people from Western UP, but basically they are trying to buy insurance. The moment the government commits to an MSP law, basically they are saying that basically it would mean that the government will continue with the current system of MSP procurement, and you know, which as you know is open ended, right? I mean, the farmers of these states benefit from the government buying much of their marketable rice and wheat, you know. So to that extent, yes, there is definitely a continuity between the two, you know. And plus the farmers in the current agitation say that you know, the legalization MSP was actually one of the promises, which not exactly the promises, but basically it's some kind of an unfinished agenda, you know, from the previous farm protests. Yeah.
I think you gave us some really important context initially in your answer when you mentioned how agricultural protests tend to be localized even during the times of pre-independent India and are likely to be concentrated in regions where there is some degree of unionization. So I would like to bring this to what organizations are participating in the protests currently. And is there any truth to the perception that MSP guarantees will only benefit certain farmers from the Punjab or Haryana region, which is usually how people perceive these things to be?
See, if you ask me, the APMC laws, the farm laws, etc., is something which most farmers in India didn't understand what it was about. Okay, and they just didn't relate to it. Okay, because one reason is that in many states you don't even have properly functioning APMCs. You know, the agricultural produce market committee mandis. You know, you don't have proper well functioning mandis, etc. So probably the farmers in other states, they didn't really relate to this movement against the three farm laws. But I believe that the idea of legalization of MSP has a much wider traction, you know, because I think every farmer today feels that when he sells his produce, he should be entitled to a fair price, you know, whether you call it an MSP or an assured price. So my feeling is that this movement, though it doesn't on paper on the face of it, it doesn't seem to be attracting the kind of crowds which happened in 2020-21. But I believe that this is something which will eventually have much wider track will have much wider traction. You know, because it's not just it's not just wheat and paddy, but every crop. You know, every crop, like for example, let's now take, say, for example, mustard. Okay, the mustard crop is today right now being harvested. Okay, the harvesting and the crop has started coming to the mandis. You know, so if you look at the prices now, you know, mustard is now selling in places like Alwar, Bharatpur, etc. Something around say 4,800 rupees per quintal. Okay. Whereas the MSP is 5,650, okay. So I'm sure every farmer would, every mustard farmer would definitely relate to the fact that he's getting a price much below the MSP, okay. And the fact that the MSP is supposed to be the government's declared price, okay. Whereas we are only getting 4,800. So I believe that this particular movement is going to have far more wider traction, you know, even though you may not see that many farmers. Of course, one reason is because, you know, the government is just not allowing anybody to come to Delhi and all these things. But I believe that this right to MSP, eventually, this demand will keep coming in some way or the other. That's my belief. Yeah, so whether it is in mustard, whether it is in not just in rice and wheat, but I think for all the crops, you know, even milk, you know, because I think we should realize that, you know, farmers basically they operate in a buyer's market, you know, because their crop is always harvested and marketed in bulk, right? And when it is marketed in bulk, it leads to sudden, you know, increase in supply, you know, relative to demand. So therefore, there is always a tendency for prices to come down, you know, and therefore farmers are always price takers, you know, they are not price makers, okay? And so when you tell farmers, farmers will typically tell you that, you know, most industries, everybody is able to set their MRPs, you know, maximum retail price. Whereas we are the only guys. We don't have the power to decide our price, you know, because so much of our crop is marketed in bulk, you know, and we are simple, you know, we are kind of passive price takers, you know. And plus, you know, so I like to, you know, always highlight, you know, two laws of agriculture, you know, which I call them two universal laws of agriculture. The first thing is, it is the only business where you have both production and price risk. Okay, let me elaborate this. Let's take say a Maruti or a Reliance Jamnagar factory. Okay, the chances of their plant getting flooded or, you know, getting destroyed in an earthquake, you know, it will be probably or maybe even a labor strike, maybe once in, you know, maybe once in 10 years, maybe once in 30 years kind of a thing. Okay, so for them, you know, there is hardly any production risk. If at all they face, it would be, say, price risk. Okay, mainly because, say, maybe the prices of crude may shoot up. Right, or the prices of steel may go up, etc. Okay, so most businesses largely face only price risk, you know, or it may be production risk, okay, but not the two together. Whereas farming is one business where you face both production and price risk, you know, right from the time I sow, okay, till I market my crop, you know, there are all kinds of production risks, okay. You could have dry weather, you know, so because of which I cannot sow, right? There could be pest and disease attacks, you know, like you could have, say, pathogens, you know, whether it is various fungus, you know, fusarium wilt, you know, alternaria blight, etc. Okay, and of course pests, we know, right? We know aphids, jassids, bollworms, and all kinds of things, you know. And then so you have dry weather. You have you have pests and diseases. Then you can have frost. You can have unseasonal rains. You know, and then you can have temperature spikes. Like right now, for example, we are in March. You know, the wheat is now in the last stage of grain filling. You know, when grain filling is what ultimately decides yields. You know, today now if suddenly the temperatures were to spike, you know, beyond say 35 degrees. Then the yields, you know, are compromised. Okay, so the farmer during this hardly 4 or 5 months of the cropping season, he encounters, you know, production risk on a daily basis, and on top of it is this price risk, you know, how prices oscillate. So I think an average farmer today believes that, you know, at least they should be protected. Ideally, say we should be able to protect them from production risk through crop insurance. And I think price risk can be covered, I think, basically through this MSP mechanism. Okay. So one rule of farming, as I said, one law of farming is that it's the only business in the world where there are both production and price risk. Okay. And the second law of farming is that it's the only business where you sell everything wholesale. Okay. And you buy everything retail. Right. The farmer pays retail price for everything, you know, whether it is seed, whether it is fertilizer, whether it is pesticide, whether it is you know, everything, for everything he pays the retail price, right? And of course, like you and me, also for toothpaste, for shirt, for TV, etc., right? So therefore we have to recognize that this is a very special business, you know, and also given the fact that, you know, the fact price, the farmers are invariably price takers, you know. So I think we need to treat this business a little differently, and I am pretty certain that this right to MSP, it will come back in some form or the other.
I'm really glad you brought in the economic context to this conversation. And I think you very effectively illustrated how the production risk and price volatility are such important factors within the farmer's economic calculations. And I think, like, with climate change and changing weather patterns, these problems are likely to just get more acute. But if we sort of flip this and look at it from the government's perspective, how do you think the government can make the economics around minimum support price work so as to not impact food prices and also not affect India's export competitiveness in food production.
Yeah, so if you agree with me, the issue is not why MSP, but how MSP. I think that's what we are finally, you know, coming to, you know, because I believe that the case for an MSP assurance, you know, it is self-explanatory, you know, and more so for a country like India. Okay, let's remember that we are a country of 1.4 billion. I don't know, 1.5 billion. We may end up at something like 1.7 billion. Okay, so we have too many mouths to feed. Okay, and the world is not going to meet our requirements. Okay, maybe yes, today we are managing to import edible oils, right? We are a huge importer, but we saw what that would what the Ukraine war did, right? And how the entire thing got disrupted and how prices really went through the roof, right? I mean, after the Ukraine war and also, you know, countries like Indonesia, you know, announcing export controls on palm oil, you know. So similarly, say suppose there is a dry weather in Argentina and Brazil, same thing, you know. So India is very different from other countries, right? Number one, we have too many mouths to feed. Okay. Number two, the world cannot take care of our requirements. So therefore, it is in our interest to ensure that farmers are in business. Okay. And this is something like, I mean, this is something which actually a country like the U.S. Recognizes, right? I mean, for the U.S., food is a strategic sector, you know, just as much as defense or any other sector, because they know that the day they are going to have to import wheat from, say, Russia, you know, then you forget about all superpower, etc., right? And therefore we need to think long term about food. Okay, how is it that we are going to, you know, say 20 years from now, 30 years from now, how are we going to meet the requirements of 1.5 billion, 1.6 billion mouths, right? So that can only come if farmers are in business. And when I say farmers, not just the current farmers, right? But also the farmers' children, their grandchildren, you know. How do we ensure that these people continue to farm, right? Like my grandfather was a farmer. My father wasn't interested in farming. And I obviously don't have land to farm, right? But how do we ensure that people, you know, that the current lot of farmers, you know, they are interested in farming? So I think one way to do it is by giving them some kind of an assured, you know, price or income. Okay, now there are basically conventional ways of the MSP, whatever, the legalization of MSP demand being met. Okay, one way is basically forcing, you know, the trade to pay, okay, the MSP. Okay, this we know is not practical, right? I mean, I cannot tell the trade you have to pay the MSP. The trade will obviously, you know, the trade is obviously going to pay whatever is the market clearing price, right? I mean, today I have demand for say 100 kgs at a certain price. So I'm not going to pay more than that price, right? And so one way of doing it, which is forcing the private trade to pay the MSP, is not practical. Okay, the second route could be that the government buys all the grain that is coming to the market and offered at the MSP. That again is not practical. The government can do it in the case of, say, paddy and wheat, because government needs rice and wheat for the public distribution, right? It needs a minimum kind of a thing. But what is it going to do with mustard? What is it going to do with linseed? What is it going to do with safflower or copra? Okay, now government cannot buy, and then, you know, and it doesn't have the facilities to process all these things, and then after that to sell, etc., right? I mean, the government is trying hard, you know, like for example, now they are trying to sell even dal, you know, under the brand of Bharat. Okay, But definitely, I don't think the government beyond a point should be in this business of buying and selling. Our government is not a trader. Okay, neither is the government a trader, nor is the farmer a trader. Farmer is basically a producer. Okay, so that brings us to a third option, you know, which I believe is the most realistic option. You know, that is let the farmer sell at the going price. You know. Let him sell at whatever the ruling prices, okay. And then basically, and suppose you have the MSP, okay. The government just simply pays him the price difference, like as I said in the case of mustard today, okay. Today, as I said, the MSP is 56.50, whereas mustard is being sold in the mandis at 4,800 rupees. So the government pays the difference. 56.50 minus 100, and for the quantity that the farmer sells, you know, it could be 20 quintals, it could be for 25 quintals, you know, so the price difference the government can then just pay into the farmer's account, and this will not cause any inflation because the private trader is buying it at the going market rate. Right. And so this doesn't actually interfere with the market mechanism. So I believe that this is the way we should go forward, you know, and this approach, I think, has two or three big advantages. OK, one advantage is, see, today, all your entire farm trade is cash based. OK, the farmer sells, he's paid in cash. Right. There is no money trail, nothing. Okay, but the moment the farmer knows that he's going to get a price difference, what will happen is that the farmer will now start demanding a receipt from the buyer. Okay, because this would work something similar to the GST, right? In the case of GST, you know that we know that in the case of the GST. It is after all the buyer who will insist, right, that the seller has paid the GST so that he can avail of the input tax credit. So a similar situation can come where the farmer will start now demanding the receipt. Okay, and this is number one, you know. So we will have a formalization of the trade, you know, and where I know, you know, how much crop has been traded, sold at what price, and everything, you know. And this in turn, so this will be something like the stock market, right? Today in the stock market, there is enough data on how much of Reliance shares I have bought at what price. When, what time, everything. Okay, but today we have no records at all of how much wheat a particular farmer has sold, you know, at what price, you know, and because of this, we also don't have good data on production, right? I have no idea, you know. We know is about the transactions which are happening in the mandis, you know, the arrivals which are happening in the mandis. But a lot of produce today is sold outside the mandis. Right, it may be sold right in front of the farmer's farm, right? So there are no records, etc. Okay, but once you have this price difference mechanism, you know, where the farmer himself, you know, insists that I get a receipt, you know, which I can then use to claim the price difference, you know, I think you will have the entire formalization of the trade happening. You know, and then, you know, everything. So one of the things which actually the Modi's farm laws actually envisaged was that the trade can happen outside the premises of your APMC mandis, you know, which could include even say online platforms. So now you can actually have online platforms. See, all I want is a record of how much a farmer has sold and at what price, you know. So I believe I believe that this kind of an ecosystem is very much required, and actually, you know, a right to MSP can actually, you know, will actually, you know, it many boxes, you know. Number one, as I said, you know, it will take care of our long-term food security requirements, right? I mean, because farmers have to be in business. And as I said, it's not just the current farmers, but even their children and their grandchildren. If they don't produce, you know, then the food security of our future generations is going to be compromised. Number two, as I said, you know, this is going to lead to a formalization and digitization of the entire farm trade. Right? Today it's all, you know, cash and totally non-transparent, very opaque. You know, nobody knows. Nobody knows how much of soybean has been sold to whom at what price, you know. But whereas I think this is something which can really happen. And then lastly, you know, the government says it wants crop diversification. I stay in Delhi. Okay, I want the Punjab farmer to move away from rice, you know, burning the crop stubble, etc. Why should farmer, instead of rice, grow bajra, millets, or maize when there is no price assurance, right? We want farmers to produce more pulses, you know, more oil seeds, right? And even fruits and other things. You know, like this time in Punjab, for example, you know, kinno was sold at, you know, 2 rupees, 3 rupees a kg. Okay, so and we want this farmer to move away from paddy to, say, growing a horticulture crop. What incentive does that farmer have? You know, but I think when the moment you start assuring him of MSP, you know, farmer will produce anything, you know, and farmers, unlike other economic agents, you know, they are very responsive to prices. Like, for example, this year we have seen in the case of Jeera, for example, you know, the acreage has gone up, you know, has almost tripled this time, you know. And why? Because prices were very good last year, right? When prices are good, farmers will automatically, you know, produce those crops which give them a good price. But if prices collapse, you know, and if kinno is being sold at 2 rupees, 3 rupees, etc., why would the farmer produce that this thing? So I think we need to approach it very practically, you know, not from an ideological kind of a point of view, very in practical terms, you know, what is in India's long-term interest? You know, how do we ensure that farmers remain in farming? You know, so I think it's time to move away from, you know, ideological to strategic and practical, you know. And how do we ensure that our farmers remain in business? I think that is the way we should look.
Thank you for that answer. And that really puts the economic and governance perspectives forward. And it's quite interesting also how you noted that the MSP can also lead to a diversification in the kind of crops that are produced. I want to now draw you into the political aspect. And because last month we saw that the government had deployed drones and tear gas while also cementing barricades along roads that led to New Delhi. And now farmers have been allowed to travel to Delhi under special restrictions. So how do you look at the government's response to the protests?
I think the government believes that the number of consumers are more than the number of farmers, you know. And in this case, even these farmers are basically just from, you know, a couple of states, you know. So that's why I think the government is taking a kind of a hard line on this, you know. But whether it impacts elections or anything, I'm not sure, you know, because we have seen in the past, you know, that as I said, you know, the number of consumers are always higher than the number of farmers, you know. So if 80 crore people are getting free grain, you know, they would far outnumber the number of farmers who are actually cultivating, you know. And I have always believed that the number of farmers in India are far less than what the government says, you know. I think according to the last agricultural census, I think there were something like 150 million farmers, you know, there is 150 million operational holdings, right? And I think there are about 100 million PM Kisan beneficiaries, you know, the people who are given 6,000 rupees a year kind of thing. Okay. Whereas my own estimates is that, you know, probably the number of serious farmers, the people that is people who are, you know, actually dependent on agriculture as a source of income for the family, you know, and I have calculated that that would not be more than, say, about 40 million. Okay? So India has just about 4 crore farmers. You know, it's not the figures that you see, you know, that 70% of India is in rural areas and they are doing farming, etc. So the universe of farmers actually is very small. You know, if we are talking of just say 50 million people who are doing, you know, full time farming, you know, and in that sense, you know, so 40 million is not a very large vote bank, you know. And especially if these are all spread across the country, you know. So that's why my feeling is that probably farmers are not such a big, you know, are not as big a lobby today, you know, in terms of voters compared to, say, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, when India was largely an agriculture-based country. So this could also be the cynical, you know, this could also be an explanation for the rather cynical approach that the government is taking to this farm protest, you know. And whereas earlier governments used to allow farmers to come to Delhi, you know. I mean, like I remember when I came for the first time to Delhi in 1988, you know. At the time we had this farmer leader called Mahinder Singh Tikayat, who came from Western UP, and he brought in with him about something a million farmers, you know, and they were in Delhi for about 10 days, and that was Delhi, not in the outskirts, you know. It was right in front of, it was in the boat club lawns, you know. It was just in front of North Block, South Block, your Parliament, etc. And the government kind of, you know, indulged them, you know. It didn't mind, you know. And in fact, I think if I remember right, they even provided for water and tea, etc. You know, so governments always sought to engage. You know, whereas this is the first time where we are seeing, you know, this kind of total hostility. You know, not allowing farmers to come to Delhi. You forget about Delhi. I mean, they were not able to cross even Punjab. You know, even enter Haryana. So maybe the calculation is that, hey, these guys are not such large in numbers, you know, the consumers are huge. But as I said, you know, this is not the right way. India should not be looking at farmers from an ideological or a political standpoint. We should look at it in terms of our strategic food security in future. Okay. Again, you know, we should look at what, for example, you look at the US. US has just 2 million farmers, you know. Whereas in India, as I'm saying, you know, there are 40 million real farmers. Okay, so 40 million versus 2 million. Okay, and you see how the US, you know, treats these 2 million farmers. You know, all kinds of subsidies, income support, and all these things. And why are they doing it? They're doing it purely because they know the strategic importance of ensuring that farmers continue to farm. Farmers, their children and grandchildren continue to farm. Okay. So I believe we need a totally different approach to farming today, you know, viewing it as a business that requires some certainty, you know, and we need a proper sense of what to do with our land. You know, a lot of our fertile land is getting converted into real estate, and that will happen if farmers have no interest to farm. Right, and if more and more of our fertile lands goes to build, you know, building expressways, cities, etc., it's going to be a disaster, you know. So I think the next government, you know, whether it is Modi's or any other government, it needs to take a 50-year 50 years ahead kind of a strategic perspective on Indian agriculture. You know, what are the crops we want farmers to farm? How much of land should be used? You know, and this is something which is terribly important for a country like India. See, India is not Chile or New Zealand or somebody like that, you know, which can afford to just import all its requirements, or even your, say, Singapore. right? India is a country which we have so many people, right? And our demand for food, etc., is only going to increase, right? With rising incomes. So we need to take a long-term view on our food security, you know. So and not view things from a very short-term, you know, cynical political kind of view, you know, whether in terms of subsidies, whether in terms of stopping farmers from coming, and let's understand that these guys who want to come to Delhi, they are serious farmers. Okay, I don't believe because I met a lot of these farmers during 2020, 21, etc. Far from being, you know, whatever rich farmers, you know, landlords, the bulk of them were ordinary, hardworking, you know, real farmers, you know, and they're very serious about their business, you know. So we should not demoralize these people, you know, and agriculture should not be a sector which gets hollowed out, you know, and if we lose because the farmer is a precious human resource, you know. And if the worst lot are left in farming, you know, then we can forget about feeding our country in the next after two generations. Maybe India can then acquire. Maybe you can ask our corporates to go and acquire lands in Africa and in other countries and grow crops there. But that's not going to work, right? I mean.
Thank you, Mr. Damodaran. I think you answered my final question, which I had for you, which was regarding the impact this might have on elections. And the takeaway here is that because there are more consumers than producers, the impact is not likely to be much. And I think a larger takeaway is that there needs to be a more strategic and long-term approach, which needs to be applied to the farming sector that looks at least several decades ahead. Mr. Damodaran, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing some really insightful points. And I'm sure our listeners will also find them very helpful to understand this issue and the larger agricultural sector in India.
Thanks, Saeed. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. You were listening to South Asia Chat. You can learn more about our work by visiting us at isas.nus.edu.sg. You can also get updates on our research and publications through social media. You can find us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram.